Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. This is the aforementioned Sal, and I am solo today. As those who have seen the notifications for the show are well aware of, and because I'm live here. And this is kind of a different format, though it's in line with the free-for-alls that we've had before. If you're with us live, I'd like to invite for you to go down to the chat room. It's open over at the bottom. I've got it right next to me. I see our buddy Paul and the cow are there. And if you would like to join in the chat room, please do. And also, the phone lines are open if you'd like to call in. It's area code 347-308-8397, just like you see it on the show page. And kind of in line with our topic today, a little fun detail for you here, I have had both my primary and backup methods fall apart on me today to do the show. Now, back my nice little laptop is saying it has 18 minutes remaining because all of a sudden decided it wanted to update. So I am doing this on my phone. Audio is just fine, but that's okay. Sometimes things don't work out real well. And like I said, that might just be a fine introduction to today's show. And guys in the showroom, because nobody has complained about the audio yet, that you usually do, I assume that we're doing just fine. If not, let me know. But today, there's going to be a little bit of a tough love. I know not all, but many Midrats listeners, they also read the stuff that I post over at the blog I've had since 2004 at Blogspot. And over the last year, we've been doing parallel production over on Substack as well. So you've read what I put out last week. We did do a mid-wraps last week because my illustrious co-host has getting a little bit of civilian underway time. I got word right before the show back. He's now back, but he's tired. So I told him, rest well, enjoy. We'll get you next time. But if he just can't help himself, as always, he can call into his own show. We'll let him on. And Monday I really wasn't up to writing much, so I did my little video montage of all the commanders at ISAF and Resolute Support, and some tasty little quotes that they mentioned there. And today I want to kind of start things off by pulling a note that I did on Tuesday. I did a little bit of math. Math is always approved. If you measure it from when the Red Army left across the Friendship Bridge to the time that the Afghan government, the Soviets, built, fell, that was 38 months. It was over 3 years. So the Soviet Union, an empire that no longer exists, in its waning years of power, managed to create a government and an army that fought for 38 months. From the time that the last commanding general of Resolute Support landed here in the U.S. And got that hug from Secretary of Defense Austin at Andrews Air Force Base, to the Americans basically retreating behind the wire at the Kabul airport and their president hitting the plane so he doesn't wind up like the Soviet president, Najibullah. Wound up hanging from a lamppost a few years after Kabul fell, after the UN wouldn't protect him anymore. Anyway, that was less than 1 month. So we and our NATO friends created a government and an army that was 1/38th is what the Soviets did. The reasons for that are many. There's lots of differences, et cetera, and so forth. But what I'd like today, as we're into our first week of this national humiliation, which is really the only way you can describe it, is I'm going to summarize the summer to start off with, what we've seen, and then I'm going to go back to the beginning and come forward on what I define as the eight phases of the American-Afghan War. And there are different ways to describe it, and we'll get to there one way or another. But as we start off, because this was, from the start, it was a NATO operation. And you have to be very careful when you listen to certain nations and their political representatives, what they say, and here's why. The only people that really have a reason to raise a whole bunch of hell are our friends from and our closest ally, Great Britain. Everybody has seen, I think, the record of the communication or lack thereof from us to the Brits. They have a bit under 1,000 forces there when we pulled the rug out. The Turks also have 600, but I don't have much sympathy for them for a variety of reasons I've mentioned before. I'll just use you one data point. In 08 and 09, when I was there, as we were running around in our thin skins, going back to the airport and back, trying to blend into the background, the Turks in their SUVs were cruising around town, no worries, with big Turkish flags on the side. You can derive what thoughts you want to from there. But this year, starting in even before this year, back in 2020, our NATO allies, Croatia, bugged out before the holiday season. Then in February, March, the Armenians and the New Zealanders, they only had a half dozen, but I include them there anyway because they were there from the start. Their SAS folks did great work in 01 and Task Force KBAR, a story that still needs to be effectively written about. Everybody took a breath in April, and then May is when you really started seeing people hitting the door. Portuguese, Slovenia, Spain, and the non-NATO ally Sweden, but they always had folks up at the north working with the Germans mostly, and a couple of folks at the headquarters in Kabul, just to keep a flag out front. They bugged out in May. June, the stampede to the door was well afoot. So I'm going to take a deep breath as I go over here. One, to give credit for these nations for at least sending from a few dozen to a few hundred to over 1,000 from the Germans. But in June, Albania, Austria, Belgium, Bulgaria, Bosnia, the Czech Republic, Denmark, Estonia, Finland, Georgia, Germany, Hungary, Italy, Lithuania, Mongolia, the Netherlands, Macedonia, Norway, Poland, Romania, Slovakia, and even a few folks from the Ukraine, they all went home. In July, Austrians and the Latvians did. And that left us where we are today, where you had, besides embassy personnel and maybe some other cats and dogs, but for resolute support, there was just U.S., British, Turks, and a handful of Greeks. They bugged out. And I'm going to quote here a little bit from a variety of sources that I pulled together and third hand, basically the Wikipedia for the, I forget what exactly they call that page, I think the retreat from Afghanistan. I don't want to pick and choose from it, but I think this gives a good summary of where we are, and people need to remember these things. Nothing happened in a vacuum, and nothing started happening 10 days ago. But in May of this year, the Biden administration announced that U.S. and NATO forces would withdraw unconditionally. There had been lots of parts of the Doha Agreement negotiated in 2020 with Khalilzad and the Trump administration, and that was just kind of the last straw. Once that took place, the Taliban launched their offensive that we're all well aware of, quickly advancing ahead of the collapsing Afghan army forces. And if y'all want to talk about my theories on that, we can. Heck, I'll go ahead and do this. A lot of people talking about Vietnam. There might be a few comparisons. The only comparison here is Vietnam fell 3 years, roughly, after U.S. combat operations ended in 72. They fell in 75 after the U.S. Congress, where President Biden was a member of the Senate of in 75, they cut off all funding to the South Vietnamese. That was the last straw for them. Also, history will give us more details on this, but I've had pretty reliable information come my way, and at least sounds right, and it might not be, and again, history will record this. We pulled back our contractors and other personnel that were helping the Afghans maintain the army that we trained them to fight with, i.e., the logistics, medical, and air support, especially the air support portion. We taught them to fight like we fought, and when you take that capability away from them because they didn't have the maintainers to do it, the results are what you see. There's also discussions that a lot of them had not been paid for a while. Thousands of years of military history show you that you need to pay your military. If you don't, they're no longer your military. They will be somebody else's military. Again, history will show us how that worked out. Then on the 8th of July, President Biden announced that the official conclusion of the war in Afghanistan will be 31 August 2020, that we're still hearing this week, which, yeah, good luck with that. Depending on how you define ending, I guess. And then he defended his withdrawal of troops, saying that, quote, the capability of the Afghan military, which is better trained, better equipped, and more competent in terms of conducting the war. Who briefed him? Who gave him those talking points? These are the things that historians and the press need to find out. Where did he get that? Who told him that? And those people need to be held to accountable, preferably in Congress. I don't believe the U.S. press corps is full of that anymore. Watching people this week, latest example was Jake Tapper went after Will Ruger over at Cato for some stupid reason on Twitter today, and the illustrious Mr. Ruger replied courteously, and that's just one data point of many. I hope to be proven wrong there, but Congress is going to have to do this to get this information for people. We all deserve it. And then on 12 July, Austin Miller stepped down from his post as commander of the U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan. Operation Resolute Support. Resolute. That's one word for it. Anyway, by the 12th of July, when he stepped down, the Taliban had seized 139 districts from the Afghan National Army. And U.S. intelligence reports, as people have seen, but again, we'll see what the truth is at some point down the road, said that they had another 6 months before there was a collapse. And we've all seen people talking about nobody saw this coming. I'm sorry, and I'll bring this up again later. That's simply not true. It's not true. You have one of two choices here. Either you're being lied to with fingers crossed behind the back with some caveat explaining why it's not a lie, or we have the most credentialed group of fools ever to lead a world power. Because this scenario was run through 2009 when I was at a table in Kabul running through this. That's simply not true. Anyway, U.S. Security Council in July of 2021 also put a nice little announcement out there that Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent, which is what they call the local Al-Qaeda affiliate, is still present in as many as 15 provinces of Afghanistan. That was back in July. You can probably up that number here. And they are operating under the protection of the Taliban in Kandahar, Helmand, and Nimroz provinces, which is also a violation of the Doha Agreement. but that had been going on for a while. So here we find ourselves in the summer of 2021. We went to war in Afghanistan in the early fall 2001 to eliminate al-Qaeda. And as we were trying to leave, we find out that al-Qaeda is strong in Afghanistan and they're poised for their next phase. So how do we get here? Well, as regulars here know, and over at my home blog, Afghan's kind of my thing. I was in Bahrain on September 11th. I got to bump into and sit in meetings with this highly energetic Marine Corps one-star named, at the end of that decade, I did a little tour in Kabul in 08 and 09, as I wrote about at the time, all here, all y'all seen it. And that is why it's been all an interest on me. And for a lot of the double zeros, I was working on it. And looking at it and writing about it for so long, I couldn't find where somebody else had written something that was satisfactory to me. In the events of last week, I took some stuff I'd done before and I modified it. And I wanted to put some numbers there for you as well, as maybe we dive into it. And before I do that, let me check the chat room here. Let's see what we got here. First time, hey, Nick, first time listening live. Welcome aboard. Appreciate it. We got some comments from Paul and Nick. Let's see if I got a specific question. We got some discussions about the McCain collision. Kyle, we've had some good shows on this. You might want to look up. And I think that's a great topic to talk about, you know, what happened after the 17 sailors died that summer. But we're not going to cover that today. We have other mid-wraps for that. And in the future, I think that subject will come up again. Let's see here. Nope, good comments. Islamists, they're not all Muslims. I don't know what you mean by that, Mr. Cal. But anyway, hey, Eagle One, you're lurking there. So, let me know if I screw anything up there. So let's dive into it for the numbers. Here's how I define things on phase one. I think it frames our exercise in that part of the world. Phase one, which I pretty much run from the taking Operation Rhino, where we took that airfield in the middle of the Registan Desert on 19 October 2001. That went all the way through the Battle of Tora Bora in December of 01. That's also the same time that you have the Bonn Agreement that many of y'all have seen me write about. The original sin of this whole evolution is the Bonn Agreement. And that was also the creation of ISAF, the International Security Assistance Force. NATO creation. And that was a heady time for NATO in 01, or Article 5. And we had initial ideas that things would work out as all the theory had, and it really didn't over time. So that went about 2.5 months, phase one. Phase two, and by the way, at the end of phase one, at the Battle of Tora Bora, we had 5,000 U.S. forces in theater. Phase two, that went from the creation of ISAF in December of 2001 to how I define NATO's culmination in the summer of 2007 when they failed to fill the aviation bridging force in RC South. It required the U.S. to step in at the last minute. That also was when it became firm from the Canadians that they were leaving and the Dutch were leaving. Those are the two main contributing forces to leave their maneuver forces from Afghanistan. The significance of the Canadians and the Dutch, not only pound for pound, is that they're some of the best military professionals you can find on the planet. They also fought relatively caveat-free 100 NATO soldiers did not equal 100 American soldiers for certain nations like the Dutch, the Canadians, the Brits, the Estonians, the Danes. I'm leaving a few others out here for brevity's sake. And many, for many nations, 100 of their soldiers are worth maybe 20 of ours, i.e. 20 of our soldiers could do what 100 of theirs can do. Some of them were just worthless. Yeah, you couldn't do anything with them. It wasn't their fault. They're good individuals. It was their national caveats and their nations restricting what they could do. So anyway, by the time NATO culminated the summer of 07, there were 25,000 U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Phase three goes from the summer of 2007 with NATO's culmination to when the United States culminated in Afghanistan, and that was December of 2009, which was Obama's West Point speech, where at that point he announced that we were going to be departing at, and I got to quit saying so much. Sorry about that, guys. But he said we were going to leave the summer of 2011. Of course, that wound up not happening. Something else happened the summer of 2011. But the signal was sent at that time. It was very clear to the last holdouts in the Taliban leadership that they can win this. They just didn't win it on their time. We weren't in it to win it. We had lost our patience. The shame of this was the fact that in December of 2009, the uplift of forces that started at the end of the George Bush administration, sometimes people call it the surge. They call it Obama surge. It's not Obama surge. It was planned, and the execution began under George W. Bush. The Obama team was briefed on it. They adopted 90% of it, put their stink on it, said it was theirs, and pushed it forward. So that surge belongs to both Bush and Obama, whether credit or blame. But it threw away all of that effort because then the Afghans knew they just needed to win on their time. And as we discussed at the time, and I've written a few times, you can see their most likely course of action is exactly what they did. They were going to set conditions with tribal elders in the villages to get them on their side. They were going to wait for us to go down, lose face, get weaker and weaker. They would let us leave, but they want to kick us in the door on the way out. So it's very clear that we were kicked out, not that we left on our own volition. And they would husband their forces for the inevitable civil war that would follow, which we've seen the first parts of recently, I think, up in Panjshir Valley. I think that the plan itself for the Taliban, they did an exceptional job professionally. You've got to give them a nod of respect. And I think they are pleasantly surprised that this actually went better than they thought it would. Or it maybe went exactly as they thought it would because they know their people. Sarah Chase, who I had recommended quite a few times for folks to read her 2007 book, The Punishment of Virtue, she made a point that a lot of the Taliban leadership have a Kandahari accent, and so a lot of them are actually probably from Pakistan, Quetta, the Pashtuns, and they led who they led. They won, and I think, you know, Pakistan's involvement is a show unto itself. I won't spend too much time on that. But by the time we culminated in December of 2009, we had 65,000 American forces in Afghanistan. Phase four of the operation, I run that from the December 2009 speech to the time that David Petraeus left as COM ISAF in July of 2011. The end of Petraeus's tenure there, remember he took over from McChrystal, I have that right, after the stupid Rolling Stone issue. Anyway, over 100,000 forces. And right when he left and Petraeus's job was to prepare for the decrease, that's when our force levels started to go down even further. I define phase five as Petraeus leaving the summer of 2011 to the creation of Resolute Support in December of 14. About 3.5 years, we went from 100,000 down to 25,000 forces. The phase 6 is rather short. It was from Resolute Support ending to the creation of Resolute Support in December 14 to that day when the last commander of Resolute Support stepped off the plane at Andrews Air Force Base and gave Secretary Austin a hug. Right now, that means, and when that took place, we had 2,500. Right now, we're in phase 7. That's the collapse. We may have already gone on to phase 8, which is the collapse to the last U.S. military withdrawal. Right now, we have different reports that said 5,200, others say 6,000 as of Thursday, which is about where we are. And so the collapse is done, which it probably was this week, then we would be in phase 8, which is collapse to the last U.S. military person withdrawals. The long pole in the tent there, and I may repeat it again later, is the loss of Bagram. And I mentioned in 09 we went through this scenario. One of the things that we went through was what would be our last place that we would go to. It was Bagram because it's the easiest place to defend. Kabul is millions of people, and everybody has seen the World War Z scenes around the airport. As we start collapsing that perimeter to get on the last C-130, or if they're smart, it's going to be a CH-47 to go someplace else. I don't see, unless you really pay the Taliban a hell of a lot more money than we already have, how you control that airport, because everybody else is going to leave. Morally and militarily right, the last Western forces at the airport should be American, unless the Turks can use the relationships that they've built separately over the last 20 years to let them do the final perimeter search. But I wouldn't bet what's the change in my pocket on that. And we'll have to see how that works out. Hopefully it works out to our benefit. And if that means we got to leave pallets of cash behind, then that's what we need to do. But we've got to get our folks out there. I do have a caller. Okay, well, before I go into the Washington Post article, I'm going to go ahead and see if I can get my backup. We have area code 941. Welcome to Midrats. What can I do for you?
Hey, how you guys doing? I just kind of came on. I'm listening to you. You're pretty grounded in terms of what's going on the surface. But you may think I'm a little crazy. I don't know with what I'm going to say. But I believe that everything is happening the way it's supposed to. Biden is just, you know. So I don't know if you guys are aware of, I'm sure you are, I know you are, Space Force, right? Space Force. So Trump started the Space Force because he got little bits and pieces of what actually is going on. I don't know if you guys ever saw the Countdown to Disclosure. Have you saw that?
Okay, it talks area about code 941. I'm gonna stop you right there. I appreciate you calling in, and it's obviously you have an area of interest involving things that's really not germane to this conversation, and I really don't want to go there. So, anyway, thanks for calling in. I wish you the best of luck. Okay, let's go ahead and get back to where we were before. And again, this is a live show, and today I'm taking all callers. I'm not pulling them into a side room. And if somebody else wants to call in and talk about something besides conspiracies involving Trump, that'd be a wonderful thing to do. Anyway, let me, while we're taking a break here, before I go into the numbers from the Washington Post article, we've got, let's see what we got here, Mr. Cal. We got Claude in here? Do we have Claude in here? Where's Claude? I don't know if Claude's here. But we do have area code 919. So let's pull up area code 919. This is Sal. You're on live with Midrats. Good afternoon.
Hello, Sal. I don't have any crazy theories about space, but and I've been reluctant to talk about this particular war. You might know me anyway.
Eagle One.
Yeah. Listen, you know, this is a war fought in the last 20 years, and people who've been in it in the last 20 years really should be taking having this conversation with you. And I'm kind of glad that I was unavailable to really co-host it today. But, you know, we talked about why we lost that book by Lieutenant General Bulger, who we had on the show back in December of 2019. You know, and he really summed it up pretty well. You know, I think, and I'm sure maybe some of the listeners will disagree with this, but, you know, he said, you know, part of the problem was I think you can put it down to hubris, we didn't know our foe. We didn't know how to deal with a group of people whose religion says it's their obligation to take on unbelievers. And if they lose and die, they get to go to heaven and all that good stuff. And all the bad things they do in their life are sent away by that. And if they win, then they get to all the goodies you get when you win things. So it's kind of a no-win situation. There's a really good book called Sword and Scimitar by a guy named Raymond Ibrahim. And it talks about the tribal nature of the large tribal nature of Islam or the Muslim religion. And I think those are keys to this. I don't think our generals had a handle on that at all. General Bulger put down why we lost, and this book dates back long before today, but that, you know, we didn't bother to learn about our enemy. We wasted our own assets, and we thought that our troops would be able to pull this out if we had more time. And I guess 20 years just isn't enough, but some tough decisions needed to be made, and you got to get over your own ego sometimes. As he said at some point, I think that despite the fact that I and my fellow generals saw that it wasn't working, we failed to reconsider our basic assumptions. You know, we failed to understand basically, essentially, our foe or ourselves. We simply asked for more time. I think that's pretty deadly, a condemnation and a pretty realistic assessment of what happened. And, you know, you said that the Vietnam War lessons maybe of our withdrawal from there don't apply, but the cruise I was on, we had a Navy admiral who had flown air cover for the flying of the U.S. ambassador out of Vietnam. He was upset by that, and he was upset by what's happened in Afghanistan. We also had a young former paratrooper who had served in Afghanistan. You know, he's looking back on what he did and all the people that he knew did, and it's the same sense of frustration that time and talent was wasted. And if you look at what General Bulger says, wasted because we really did not understand our foe or what we were trying to do. And, you know, when you lose that sense of the goal, up to your ass and alligators, you forgot your goal was to drain the swamp thought process that I think just speaks poorly of where things went. Anyway, I wanted to call in and add my two cents and let you know that I thought you were doing a good job handling this, and I think it's fitting that you're far more experienced in this than any old fogey like me, and you just keep going, and I think the comments in the chat room have been pretty good. Anyway, I'll hang up now, and you can get back to the show.
Well, thanks for calling in, Mark. I feel a little alone here without you, but I appreciate you calling in because you did bring up, and I mentioned it a little bit earlier, about Vietnam, and there's a lot that there's not similar between here and Vietnam, but I think the one thing that I think all of us could gain from your generation of, especially the JOs right now, when you were a JO at the fall of Saigon in 75, and you talk about the frustration and the loss and the opportunity cost of all that is in I was just a kid during it, but you saw it personally. That has some huge repercussions for the military for the rest of the 1970s, in line with some stuff going on in the culture. But I think maybe there's something your generation can do for the Gen X and millennials and the handful of Gen Z that are at the airport right now in Kabul to help everybody work through that. I think maybe the one advantage we have here is that your generation didn't have is on average, I think there's an order of magnitude more support and sympathy for those who wore the uniform in 2021 than there was in 1975. So I think there is a role for the Vietnam generation who on a personal basis, you all have seen this before, while there are a lot of people who they're either they or somebody they know are going through this feeling of loss and frustration for the first time.
Yeah, I think, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the people who were junior officers who were fighting Vietnam came up, you know, the whole Powell Doctrine based on the Weinberger Doctrine, you know, all that thought process there, if you're going to go in, go big, win it big and go home, you know, somewhere, and I will look at Somalia and Kosovo and a couple other things we've gotten into where we just didn't know when to quit. You know, you go in with the goal in mind and then get out. And I hope that the generation that is coming up is going to say the same thing. You know, we this was done wrong because we got into things we had no business messing with and couldn't succeed at anyway. Even if we stayed there 100 years, you can't change some aspects of the culture. Everybody's been broken by Afghanistan, from Alexander the Great to, you know, the Russians and now apparently us. So it's and the British. I mean, you go back in history. So it's a tough nut to crack, and probably too tough given the nature of the population you're dealing with. Anyway, I'll go away now and continue to listen and hope have fun.
Well, thanks, and I look forward to co-hosting with you next week. We'll have a great guest for everybody. So we'll talk next week and get a good
all
rest,
right.
And we'll talk separately about your underway time.
All right, thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. And we have folks from another call from a part of the East Coast that I actually like living in, and people badmouth. Oh, wait, area code 757, you just disappeared? I don't know if I fat-fingered you or not. Anyway, area code 757, please call back in. I did not mean to hang up on you, which I think I did. So, anyway, call back area code 757, nothing personal. Not even business here, just me and my big fingers. So, getting back, I'm going to go back to that Washington Post article. It came out on Thursday. But I know nobody expected for there to be math, but there's going to be a little bit of math here, and that's all right. Plenty of STEM majors. Here's a dollar figure for you. $2,261,000,000,000 in change. That's what is, generally speaking, we have spent in Afghanistan. Over 800,000 service members have served in Afghanistan. 2,352 Americans were killed. Over 20,000 were wounded. The Afghan National Security Forces, which what was the guy's name? I wrote it down. Here we go. British Army Reservist, conservative member of parliament. I believe he's the head of their Foreign Relations Committee. Tom Tugendhat, member of parliament in the UK. I'll quote him later. He made a very good point that people should be very careful bad-mouthing the Afghan National Security Forces, especially the ones of the last decade or so. 66,000 Afghans who fought with us were killed. In the process of fighting the Taliban and their friends, 47,245 Afghan civilians were killed. And of our partner nations, 1,144 were killed. So for every basically three Americans who were killed, every five Americans who were killed, there were three partner nations, i.e. mostly NATO allies. We had non-NATO allies were killed there as well. And all that got washed away in the Taliban's roughly 10-day offensive, where they took Kabul, and a little bit longer than that, but he wanted to. And it was a unquestionably a NATO operation. It frustrated me when I wore a NATO hat there, when I read the U.S. press And this, again, is the fault of the U.S. press and the U.S. military, because I didn't just see it in our press reporting. I saw it when I got up on VTCs with the Joint Staff. They do not appreciate and did not appreciate how much our allies contributed to this. And when I look at the background of a lot of these individuals in the president administration, especially those who spend a lot of time in academia, I don't think they appreciate how many of our allies, national caveats are given, I know. But they step forward and they try to help where they can, especially early on. We need to complete it. I think it's right that if for nothing else, from a first in, first out, that the last NATO forces in Afghanistan, they need to be American. I don't want them to be Turks. It needs to be Americans. We need to make sure that those who came to our side to help us try to help the Afghans, which is what it ultimately became. I know that President Biden said it was never nation building. I'm sorry. And I'll bring this up again. I don't know who's briefing it. That's just not correct. I know. I have the receipts. I wrote the goddamn, pardon my French, I wrote the operational plan. It was. That was our mission. And I'm sorry. But a lot of people came to our side to help us out. It is what it is. And this is going to impact a lot of areas. And I think, though, an instinct might be to talk back to them. I don't think that's healthy. Angela Merkel has been Chancellor of Germany for 800 years or something. I exaggerate a little bit. But anyway, Armin Laschet. He is probably going to be the head of the conservative coalition who knows, but will probably run the next German government. He called this, quote, the greatest debacle that NATO has experienced since its foundation, unquote. Yeah, I think that's fair. When you look at what the Germans and the French are trying to do, it's understandable that this is going to be used against us. We have inside our nations that we call our allies, there are cells of people that have always had latent anti-Americanism, and we have friends there. And there are, especially in France and Germany, those that want more EU and less NATO, they've been emboldened. Our opponents inside the nations that we call our friends and allies have been emboldened. Our friends and defenders and advocates and cheerleaders have all been humbled, and they're going to be humbled for a while. So the momentum is in the direction for those that want to push Europe more in the European direction. Thank goodness there was Brexit. But anyway, Lord Peter Ricketts, he's the UK's former national security advisor, said, quote, it looks like NATO has been completely overtaken by American unilateral decisions, unquote. Again, that's fair. Various reports have the British Prime Minister, who, unless you're on the commode, every president should be picking up that phone. I don't care who the Prime Minister is or what the reason is. We owe them that. They owe us that. We do not have a better friend out there. And when we need them, we want them to pick up the phone. That did not happen the way it should have. The fact that it was unilateral, whether it's true or not, that's the way it's being seen, and nobody's defending against it. Also, he stated, quote, the Afghanistan operation was always going to end sometime. It was never going to go on forever. But the manner in which it had been done has been humiliating and damaging to NATO. That also is airtight. I think good people can agree, and we've done it on Midrat. Good people can agree on whether we need to stay or go in Afghanistan. That's good people, well-meaning people can argue both sides of that. And if you pay my consulting fee, I can argue both sides of it. But how we've done it, how it was done. Don't take the bait and get into arguments about coming or going. That's not the issue. The issue is how we did it. when I say don't take the bait, unfortunately, I have to say, when you hear the Pentagon spokesman, you hear the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, you need to listen to everything they say with a highly critical and cynical ear. They have said some blatant, I'll say they're untruths. But you have one or two options here for a lot of things that they've said. Either one, they are being good little sea lawyers, and they don't think they're telling a lie, but they are telling a lie consciously. They're not telling you the truth, if you want to say it nicely. At the very highest levels of what at least this summer was the world's greatest military is led and run by over-credentialed fools who don't know what they're doing and are keeping their jobs irrespective. So take one or two choices there. I would rather take the former than the latter, because in the former, I can fire those people, and in this huge legion of well-credentialed, trained professionals, journal officers, and flag officers, I've got at least a dozen that can take each one of their places and do just as fine of a better of a job. So if they're being sea lawyers and telling clever lies that aren't very clever to us, that's a good thing, because you can always get rid of those people and replace them with people that are probably better, or at least 0.9, if we're selecting our best, more dangerous situation. And if it's an intel failure, I would encourage everybody to look at who the Joint Staff J2 is. Look at his background. He's the guy that I would like to have a congressman or a senator grill in a closed session, so there's no classification issues. He's got a story to tell, one way or the other. Hey, Area Code 757, I see that you're back. Thank you for calling in. Welcome to Midrex. You're on the air.
Hi, Sal. My name is Trey. Just had a quick question. I'm an active duty SWO that did an IA tour in Afghanistan, and I worked with a 40-man Afghan attachment from the NDS, and had a couple of Afghan interpreters, and the past, I don't know, 5 to 7 days has really been kind of a whirlwind of emotions for me. What kind of resources are out there in the surface warfare community for people that are, you know, in my position, who are kind of reflecting on their experience there?
Well,
over.
Yeah, Trey, first of all, thank you for calling in. And you're not alone is one thing. And we all think of a few people that we knew in Afghanistan and wondering where they are. How are they getting in, especially those that we owe something to because they've helped us. A former guest of the show here and friend of the show, Jack McCain, he got back, I think, a year ago from a one-year tour helping to train and mentor the Afghan Army flying the Black Hawk helicopters. If you're up on Twitter, and if you're not, send me an email and I can maybe get in touch with you. Jack has spent, because he's in a similar place than you are, I think, mentally, about the people that he's thinking about, that there are some organizations, there's some scams out there, everybody needs to be careful of, but there are some organizations, and if Jack endorses them, they're good, that are helping people. I also would say that Senator Tom Cotton's office is helping people as well. I don't if you're in Area Code 757, Representative Elaine Loria may be your rep. If not, she's not going to let a line on a map. She might be able to help you. She also has some connections in the Navy. As far as helping us talk this through, I mean, Trey, you brought up a good point. It's easy to say the chaplain, but probably the best thing that you can do, and I did something very similar last night. There are people I grew up with. I was the token Navy guy. These were mostly Army National Guard folks who had served in Afghanistan. We all got together for a cookout and philosophical drinking session. That's helpful as well. You might want to reach out to some folks that have a similar background to you. But unfortunately, if you did the type of tour you did as an IA, I assume at the most there's one or two other Americans with you. You showed up there, you did your job, and you came back. That's tough. So externally, if you're looking to help out your interpreters, find a way to find out those organizations that Jack is working with. Secondly, I would say if you're in Virginia, get in touch with Representative Elaine Loria's office. I don't know what the senators from Virginia are doing. I know there are other congressmen and senators that are helping out, but I know Tom Cotton and his team have been helping people with interpreters. I would try there. I don't know, Trey, where you are right now. Do you have very many people you work with who have done an IA tour in Iraq or Afghanistan like you did?
Yeah, right now I'm in training up in Newport for an EXO tour, but it's kind of rare to encounter people who have my same experience, and that's one of the things that's been difficult in the SWO community, right? You know, I'm about 6 or 7 years past the IA tour experience, but you know, the events of the past week or so have kind of brought all those experiences back into the forefront for me. And
sure.
The chaplain has been my best resource, but I can't imagine I'm the only person out there that's experiencing the same thing. And I'm just kind of curious, where I should point other sailors, should they have the same thoughts that I have.
I'll tell you what, Trey, do me a favor. If you don't mind, send me an email to cdrsalamander@hotmail.com and just say, hey, this is Trey. I called in from Midrats. I'm up in Newport, .. Let me pull a few threads for you. I know some folks up at Newport that might be able to point you in the right direction. So, give me 24 to 48 hours to shake a tree and see if something pops out, and I'll reply to you. So if you'd like me to do that for you, just drop me an email, Trey, and I'll see what I can do.
Yep, absolutely, Sal. I appreciate it.
Thanks, and hey, good luck, EXO. And we have area code 302. We also have a call in. Area code 302, this is Sal. You're on the line. Area code 302. Going once. Going twice. Stage right here. Oh, 302. I'll tell you what, if you get over stage fright, or if you probably already dropped the line, I'll keep you up here for a minute. Anyway. Back into our stats here. Let me check the old chat room. Hey, Maggie, thanks for coming and joining us. We got to find a reason to grab some drinks. Y'all don't know Boston Maggie, shame on you. She's always been a great supporter of the Navy in general and also of the show. And so, Maggie, it's really great to have you on board here. 302, let's see if we can bring you back again. I got you 8 seconds. My interface on the switchboard is going pretty well. Area code 302, if you want to speak, I've got you unmuted. Just pop in when you can. 302, you've got some problems there. Okay, so we don't have area code 302, but you're more than welcome to call back in if you would like to. I'll pick up where I left off. I was talking first in, first out. But let's look at kind of what the title, I'll give you the abbreviated title, of my Tuesday post. It's a systemic government failure. There's no question in my mind that's what we have here. It's a whole government failure, and I've already mentioned to you that you have two options to look at, that as you listen to these press conferences. I've said a few times, John Kirby has an impossible job, but he's not the one that I'm really concerned about the most. He has a job to do. He has a place in the ecosystem. He's just doing his job. I think people who are putting some energy towards him are putting him in the wrong direction, and I know that is part of John Kirby's job, is to be the institutional sin eater, but that's not the person that you should really be investing your time with. Hey, we got area code 484. I'll pick up where I left off, but area code 484. This is Sal. You're on the air.
Hey, Sal. How you doing?
Doing well.
Good. Forgot I'm on the show. I don't have the same experience you had, but, you know, we shoot some of the same dirt. I was there before and after you, 06, 07, and then 10 through 12. And
yeah,
I saw a lot of the things that you mentioned, and I think you're doing a really good job of summarizing, you know, what there was. I saw lots of Afghans who wanted to make a difference, but, you know, you think our situation is bad or difficult. Theirs was even worse because there was nobody. Every time you talked to somebody, and I'm talking Herat, Kandahar, Uruzgan, anywhere you went, the connections went back and back to the war with the Russians and before that, and the war with the Northern Alliance, and who was on which side and who fought for who and all this stuff. And sometimes they were on the Taliban side, sometimes they were on the government side, and they were all interconnected. It was worse than, you know, it's very impossible to explain to folks that haven't seen it or experienced it.
Those tribal and social dynamics in Afghanistan, it's in our mind, it is so hard for us to get a handle on, because in the Western experience, the closest people can come to it is, you know, the Scottish clans, but those were, by the time modern history came around, they were all well-tamed. People can't appreciate those interconnections and societies. I remember a Marine who was in RC East early on in the war said the frustrating thing for him was they kept calling them Russians, and they were trying to explain to them, we're not Russians. But they say, well, you look like Russians to us. What do you want? His take was that the folks over in Nuristan and stuff, those are just some hillbillies that wanted to do their smuggling and be left alone. And we wouldn't have trouble with them if we just let them do their smuggling, their illegal timber harvesting. But yeah, this was mentioned by, I'm trying to remember who it was. It's not important, but this is about the Iraqi invasion, but it applies to Afghanistan and spades. It says the longer we were there, the greater the mass of the people became an antibody to us. And a lot of our decision makers were in Kabul, which even back in the 1970s, before the Soviet invaded, find little hints of modernity there. But, you know, it was like out in the countryside there. It's a different world. You talk to Afghans. Remember, I was sitting down with a bunch of Afghan colonels, and half of our conversation was about their relatives in Belgium and Germany and Canada and the fact they came back there for a few years. But those aren't really the Afghans that you're dealing with. And it was so hard for us to crack that code. In the end, how much did that impact? I don't know. But it didn't help us. And there'll be plenty of people writing books about it. How much it'll apply to other parts of the world, I'm not sure. But last week, one of the things I did is I looked at the notes I took for we would do the equivalent of a staff ride on staff in Kabul, where everybody was assigned to do some history lesson. And I did one about the first Anglo-Afghan War and hadn't looked at it really since 08. But all those interplays about tribal affiliations and tribal loyalties, it was all right there in the first Anglo-Afghan War. And, you know, what we think as betrayal isn't what they consider betrayal. And what they consider, what we would consider a binding agreement, is not what they consider a binding agreement because of their culture. And I just think that the deeper that we got into that country, the more that we got tied up in all those intricacies, and it didn't help us somewhere in the middle. Yeah. I don't know. You and I can't explain it to each other. I don't know how we explain it to the general population.
No, I think you've got a several points right there that were very, very good. I think you've probably heard the Afghan expression, especially outside of Kabul. The expression that they always used was, you know, I'm from one valley, you're from another.
Yeah.
People couldn't understand each other. That was what they would say. Like, you're, and it was so true, because the terrain was so difficult, so aggressive, that it was literally, to get from one village to another could take you 2 days, you know, even if they were just sort of a couple miles apart, because in between was this huge ridge, this huge mountain. And so you'd have to walk all the way down to the end and back. So, you know, I was coming in there thinking that we would, if this was the big expression after we overthrew the government, that we were going to set up a central government based in Kabul. It was a non-starter. It's never been their history, and there was no way that was going to happen. You're right. We did have that mission of nation building. I saw it, I read it, and that was the marching orders. But I don't know how you get there from here with those people. I mean, meaning the people who were alive and adult and decision makers, you know, you just weren't going to change them in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years to become a Western democracy.
And I think that's the story that I really want to be told, because one thing I bring up on a regular basis is the Bonn Accords of December of 2001 and the lead nation construct that came ahead of time. While we being the military side of the house, were doing the Battle of Tora Bora and trying to catch bin Laden before he crossed into Pakistan, and the Pakistanis stabbed us in the back like they do. Anyway, different topic for a different day. But while that was going on the civilian side of the house, you had all the foreign policy, academia, intelligentsia in D.C. and Brussels, London, et cetera, were developing this great theoretical way of remaking Afghanistan based upon something the model UN would come up with a bunch of 16-year-olds over a weekend, that NATO spent the next 6 years trying to make happen, 5.5 years till they culminated in 07. And then we, the U.S., was left, okay, do we take the keys back here? What are other options? And we kept talking ourselves into it. And when my co-host was up here for a little bit, I think part of it may have been that, and last Monday I did a collage of all the commanders of OSAP, of ISAF, and Resolute Support. Especially in the first few years of the war, the senior military person there was there 6 months, and it could go from a Brit to a Turk to an American to a German to a Frenchman. And so nobody ever really had ownership, and they walked in the door and they're like, oh, well, this guy was, and his team was an idiot. I'll do better. And you know what it's like, anything in a military organization, if you're lucky, 6 weeks in, you know what your job is. And 6 weeks before you leave, you got to start preparing your turnover. So that's, you know, let's do heavy math here. 6 times 2 is 12 divided by 4. That's 3 months. That's half of your tour is figuring out how to get to the head and how to tell the next guy to get to the head. So I don't know how, from a military point of view, you should only have a 6-month tour if you're fired for incompetence. But that, I think, in the military side of the house is part of it. But the accountability that I want to see, and I appreciate you for kind of setting me up here to go into my next line, I'm more than happy for we on the military side of the national security ecosystem to work this out with each other. But damn it, I want the Department of State, I want USAID, I want the CIA, I want the DEA, I want those people to be held to an equal account. So anyway, before I let you go, yeah. Do you have any other, oh, by the way?
I You know, you've mentioned it in passing a couple of times, and I certainly don't mention it enough on the news, and that is the amazing job that so many individuals did from the different countries. I know that I worked with a lot of folks from a lot of different countries, and to a person, they were dedicated to the job, they were dedicated to the mission, and the parameters that their country set for them, and they would, you know, sometimes when they could, because we had to be more proactive.
You're breaking up.
Aggressive. Yeah. I'm sorry.
You're breaking up. But
very, very helpful, and they did their jobs, and they were professionals. And my hat is off to all of those folks that came and served with us, you know, side by side for all these years, as well as, you know, the folks we're trying to save now, the interpreters, the other folks that did work with us. So I'll just leave you with that, and thanks for the time.
I appreciate you calling in. Your points are really solid. And for those that aren't listening, when you hear the callers, for those that have done some tours in Afghanistan, I hope you're seeing an undercurrent thread there. And one reason why I'm kind of doing the show that I am here today is we've got to talk about this for two reasons. One, there's still work to do. There are still Americans to get out of the country. We still have young men and women wearing the uniform at the Kabul airport, trying to figure out the best way to get to the last C-47 out of there, or whatever it's going to be. But there's a lot of us who need to work through our experience, what we've done, who we've done with it, and we owe it to the truth to make sure that we don't let other people spin this, warp this, or change what we know and we saw, and hold them accountable, whether they're wearing a uniform or not. And I think we all need to do it on an individual basis, and we need to help each other out. If you need to make a call, make a call. If you get a call, pick it up, even if you're busy. Somebody may have decided you're the one person that they're comfortable talking to about this, whether they spent 2 weeks on the ground, 2 years, or whether it was their dad or their mother, civilian or military. We gotta talk this through, and that's helpful. I just want to pivot here. I know we're over the hour, but I got us 90 minutes because I was hoping we'd get some calls, and we did. But I mentioned earlier when I was talking to our last caller about people that I want held accountable. I talked about some organizations. But as we're going through this whole of government failure that we started seeing at the end of July and we're living with right now, at the very top, Secretary of State Blinken, those that did not see him on the television today, you need to watch that. We had indications of that he might be out of his element at the Anchorage with the Chinese, and he's out of his element here. And if he's covering for his boss, he's not doing a good job of it. If he's trying to do his boss's job for him, he's misserving the nation. The Secretary of State, I've got no use for. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, he came from academia, and it shows. Again, I don't need to say anything about him. I said too much about Secretary of State, which, by the way, I've had people tell me they're great, wonderful individuals. Well, I'm sure they're great and wonderful, but they're not doing their job. They are the senior leaders of this whole government failure. Jake Sullivan, he needs to go back to New Hampshire. Find somebody else for the job. You failed the president. You failed the nation. Nobody should be surprised. And that leads to the Secretary of Defense, Austin. For, I think, almost 3 years, I could be wrong, he was U.S. CENTCOM commander. Maybe it was just 2 years. Anyway, doesn't make a difference. It could be 2 months. He knows the story. He was CENTCOM while one of our callers here was serving on the ground. He knows the story. He knows the importance of Bagram. He knows that a rapid collapse was briefed and discussed for years as possible red most dangerous course of action. if the Taliban were able to do it, and they would. Nobody should have been shocked. All the indications were there, especially during the month of July, this was happening. Even earlier, if you look at everybody who left in June, they saw it was coming more than anybody else. Or they just had a lower risk tolerance, which may be true. I think Secretary of Defense Austin's an honorable man. I think he's a good man. But again, he and his organization have failed the president and have failed the people. He needs to take accountability for this. I understand the theory that I need to stay in this job while there are people still at the airfield. I got news for you. You're not a general. You're a civilian appointee. We have generals on the ground who are responsible for that tactical event. Your responsibility as Secretary of Defense is at the pole mill level. You have failed miserably in this position. And your performance and that of your chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in press conference communicating to the American people and the international community speak for themselves. And listeners, I would encourage you to go watch them if you have not watched them at all. And that brings me to General Milley. I don't know anybody who has defended him. They don't believe him. And I don't think they have a reason to believe him. Because as we've mentioned earlier on the show, we have one of two options here. One, for the Secretary of Defense and General Milley and the entire chairman of the all the Joint Chiefs of Staff, one of two things happen. Either one, their advice and recommendations were ignored, or two, what we're seeing happening right now is a direct result of their advice and recommendations. I understand you go behind the closed door, you have your ideas, the boss has his ideas, shut down. He says, we're doing this, you walk out the door, you execute it. Yep, roger that, that's in the finest traditions of the U.S. military and the way it's supposed to be done. But that doesn't mean that you have to accept responsibility for it. That doesn't mean you need to take it. That also doesn't mean that your obligation is to that politician's reputation. Your obligation is not to that individual's spin. Your obligation is to the Constitution and the American people and your own soul, their decision. From a military point of view, all those individuals could go on a four-month fishing trip and the U.S. military would function the same without them. What's important, though, is a larger message. Is what we're seeing right now acceptable to the U.S. military? Of course it's acceptable because that's how we work. We follow the orders of those that go in front of us. But if you're going to stay on, you own it. It's yours. I don't want to read a book that says that he didn't take my advice, and if I didn't stay in, everything would fall apart. Nobody's that good. Can do a lot of good to our allies and our friends by saying, you know, we are a nation of laws. We will execute the orders of the president as an organization. But I offered my best advice, and obviously I don't have the confidence of the commander-in-chief. I am not doing my job well enough that my recommendations are accepted. Therefore, I tender my resignation and let somebody else execute the president's efforts as ordered. And that would be very honorable to do for somebody to get the phone call and it's like, hey, you're the next chairman. You're the next CNO. Here are your orders. Execute. That's fine. So he needs to decide which one of those stories he wants history to tell. We're not going to have a third story. At least I'm not. And I'm not buying his book. I'll read the excerpts. That may seem easy for me to say, sitting in the cheap seats here in sunny Florida, but that's okay. I'm fine with that. I also, on his staff, and I hate to say it because he's a Navy man, but he is just the joint staff, J2, was just promoted vice admiral. I would ask you if the performance of the intelligence community this fiscal year justifies its greatest, most senior intelligence officer to be given an additional star. I'll just leave it on the table. I don't think it does. Let me go ahead and see what we've got here. Legal foundation. We've got political theory. Let's see, Mr. Cal, wouldn't it be refreshing for the civilian defense leadership which allowed this debacle to fall on their swords? I don't think anybody needs to fall on their swords. I think the honorable thing to do is to say, if you really disagree with what's happened, that to acknowledge the fact and let the American people know and our allies and friends know who ultimately this decision was. I do not have the faith and confidence of my commander-in-chief. We will execute his orders, but obviously the commander-in-chief needs senior military advisors who share his worldview and share his priorities. And I wish my predecessor, my relief, the best of luck. Thank you very much. Have a nice day. That's what needs to be done. But will it be done? Maybe next week, maybe next month. Maybe not at all. I don't know. Not my area of expertise, and we'll just have to figure it out as we go along. I don't have any callers. I need to check and make sure I got all my little notes. I do appreciate everybody who has joined us here today to talk this through. If we have a listener who was like one of my call-in folks that needs some help with the interpreters or folks they know, please follow the advice I gave before. And if you want to pop me an email, maybe I can pull a thread here or two as offered before. I'll do my best. I don't pretend I have any inside knowledge. I don't pretend I have any inside levers. But I do know a few people I can touch with that may or may not be able to help. I don't know. I would just leave in this note. Whether you served or not, you might know somebody who had. Do what we can to help each other, both those in theater and out, and work it through. And as the weeks and the months and the years go forward, keep yourself educated, keep yourself informed, and we will see, as we've already seen, people will try to spin and change what you've seen with your own two eyes and your own ears. Don't let them do that. Along the same lines, we've seen it already. There's lots of false news reports out there. There's fake news. There are sociopaths who get a pleasure from creating stuff out of thin cloth just to see people react to it. This is no time for doing that for serious people. If you see somebody bite off on something that you know is wrong and incorrect, don't publicly shame them. Tap them on the shoulder, send them an email, phone call, DM, something, say, hey, you may want to think twice about believing this individual or believing this report, this news source, things like that. We have got to have a good grounding in the truth, and we have to let well-meaning people have the facts that they need to figure out what's going on. And hopefully we're able to do some of that today. And I do appreciate everybody joining us here in the chat room. Make sure nobody had any last-minute questions. Good thing to see Eagle One keeping everything straight there. And besides that, thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. We'll be back to our normal format next week with a great guest. And until then, hope you have a great Navy Day, everybody. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.